Would you open your Bibles to Ecclesiastes chapter 2? There's a little boy that went out to his backyard with a baseball and a bat. He wanted to get in some practice, had his little baseball hat on. And he went out and he proclaimed out loud, "I'm the greatest batter in the world." He threw up the baseball and took a whack at it and he missed. He was undaunted. He picked up the baseball and he said, "I'm the greatest batter in the world." Of course, first he swung it and he said, "Strike one." You know, he's playing the game, imaginary game with himself. He says, "I'm the greatest batter in the world." Throws it up the second time, swings, and he misses the second time, and he says, "Strike two." Now, this time he examines the bat to make sure it's not flawed, straightens out his baseball cap, spits in his hand, rubs it together like any good baseball player would. Throws the ball up in the air again after saying, "I'm the greatest batter in the world." Throws it up, takes a whack at it, and he misses it third time, and he says, "Strike three." And then he proclaims out loud, "Wow, I'm the greatest pitcher in the world." That's an optimist. Knowing all that you know about Solomon so far, if he would have been that kid, what would he have said after three strikes? He would have said, "What's the purpose of this stupid game anyway? Vanity, vanity, all is vanity." And you have before you the journal of a pessimist, somebody who experimented with life and tried many things to find fulfillment. Every time he tried something, the disillusionment grew. He pursued intellectualism. He pursued wine, women, song. He acquired things. He built things. And with every turn of the road, the hole inside of him got bigger and bigger and bigger. Life was to him like the cotton candy that you get at the fair. It looks so big, doesn't it? You think, "I'm getting a good deal, 50 cents for all of that." It's only an ounce and a half of sugar. A little food coloring, a little flavoring, put it in a spinning machine, and it's that big. But it's fluff. And life promised him so much, but he found out it was just fluff. Vanity, he calls it. Verse 12 of chapter 2 begins with the phrase, "Then I turned myself to consider." That phrase marks a change. He's saying, in effect, "I'm going to try a different tactic. I'm going to look at this from a different angle." And rather than experimentation, this is observation. He's going to carefully, objectively observe life. It's his outlook, I call it. His outlook is a comparison. He will, in the next few verses, compare two different approaches to life: the approach of the wise person versus the approach of the fool. He will philosophize on that and come up to a conclusion. He will then compare two different approaches to work, to labor. Is it better to work, or is it better just to get a good inheritance and not work, have somebody else do it? After that outlook, the last few verses, comes his uplook. He looks up, beginning in verse 24 to the end of the chapter, and rather than comparing, he is now comprehending life's purpose. Let's begin then in verse 12 with his outlook as he compares two different pathways of life. "Then I turned myself to consider wisdom, madness, and folly." So he's going to compare now two different approaches: wisdom versus foolishness, as he calls it, madness and folly. "For what can the man do who succeeds the king? Only what he has already done. Then I saw that wisdom excels folly, as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceive that the same event happens to them all. So I said in my heart, 'As it happens to the fool, it also happens to me. Then why was I more wise?' And I said in my heart, 'This also is vanity. For there is no more remembrance of the wise than the fool forever. Since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come, And how does the wise man die? As the fool. In comparing wisdom versus folly, he's not speaking of somebody who's a fool in the sense of lacking intelligence versus somebody who's very learned. Necessarily, though, he did consider himself to be very learned. The idea here is comparing a wise approach to life, that is a calculated approach, a staid, conservative, planned, thought-out way, versus the foolish approach to life, wild, careless, carefree kind of an approach. A fool, in this context, is somebody who jumps into life with a reckless abandonment, not really thinking about the consequences. Que sera, sera. Whatever comes, I'll take. Solomon's initial conclusion is, well, it's a lot better to be wise. At least you know what you're up against. Notice in verse 14, he says, the wise man's eyes are in his head. That simply means he can see what he's up against. He can see the pitfalls in the road, and if he's wise, he'll steer clear of them. The fool walks in darkness, can't see where he's going. Better than to live your life aware, both eyes open. However, Solomon, being Solomon, keeps thinking about this thing a little bit deeper. His observations are more probing, and he takes that to the very end of life. And notice again in verse 14, he says, you know, no matter what road you take, the same event happens to them all. What event would that be? Death, exactly. Death is the great equalizer, the great leveler. We all die. That's the going rate, isn't it? One out of one dies. And so he thinks, well, what's the difference? If I get educated, if I get rich, if I'm wise, I'm going to die. If I'm poor and I'm dumb, I'm going to die. The same event happens to them all. So what does it matter if I get a fine education or not? Last week, Franklin alluded to that Concord plane crash that happened this last summer, the tragedy where so many were killed. I was over in Europe when that happened, and I got the news article. And here's a snippet of that article. The article was entitled, Wine and Fire. The author says, they, that is the passengers, sat around in a high-ceiling lounge at Terminal A, sipping their champagne and eating their sandwiches. Although the plane wouldn't leave the gate for another hour, this became their last meal. Do you ever think that when you sit down to a meal? Probably not. Some of you do. This might be my last meal. Now, I don't want you to be morbid all the time when you eat a hamburger. This is it, man. But it could be. Not necessarily because of the hamburger, but you never know. But do those thoughts ever go through your mind? This could be it. What do I have to show when it's all over? What's left? Verse 16, he digs deeper and he says, there is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever, since all that now is will be forgotten in days to come. Now, we desperately try hard to make sure that verse doesn't come true. When somebody dies, we want them remembered. We make tombstones, not tomb notes. There's no tomb cardboards. We want their name etched in rock, stone, so that they'll be remembered. But we're fighting a losing battle because eventually people will be forgotten. The family will remember, of course. But by and large, as those generation continues, nobody remembers. Time tarnishes all things, renders all things forgettable, hazy, fuzzy. There are some impressive monuments around the world, the Taj Mahal being one. That's simply a gravestone to a wife of an emperor. Or the pyramids. We know about them, but you probably don't know the names of who's in there. We forget about them. Time will do that. And Solomon thinks about this, and it's awfully debilitating to his thinking. Everybody's going to be forgotten. But it's true, isn't it? I mean, who cares today that Zachary Taylor or William Henry Harrison won the election for President of the United States? You go, who? they were the president of the United States? That's right. Nobody thinks about them anymore. Nobody really cares. Those aren't the names being bandied about in this day and age, are they? But let me tell you something. The two names that are being touted because of what's going on down in Florida will be forgotten just as these are. And who cares that the Brooklyn Dodgers beat the Yankees in the 1955 World Series? You say, oh, that's so long ago. Not really. Or how about this name, ladies? Do you remember John Gilbert? Now, come on, he was the biggest romantic male movie star in the 1920s. Everybody knew him. He was a household word. Nobody's heard of him today. He's forgotten. Solomon carries this thinking down to the very depth of his mind and heart in verse 17. It's the lowest point of the whole passage. It says, and listen to him, therefore, I hated life. Man, he's disgusted, isn't he? Because of the work that was done under the sun, it was distressing to me, for all is vanity and grasping for the wind. This shows you the depth of depression that's going on inside of his mind. After all of the personal experimentation, chapter 1 and first part of chapter 2, after all the objective observation that he just made, the hole inside of Solomon is bigger than it was before. Now keep in mind, this is under the sun philosophy. That's the phrase he uses in verse 17 and verse 18, four times in the passage. Under the sun, under the sun. Life on the horizontal, looking around, you're tasteless, you're bored, you're empty. I have a paragraph written, I don't know by whom, it's an anonymous author, but obviously he chose to live his life on the horizontal. He did not consider God. He made certain choices for pleasure. And yet when it was all done toward the end of his life, listen to what he writes, and listen to how much it sounds like Solomon. Quote, how foolishly I have employed myself. In what delirium has my life been passed? How I've wasted my life while the sun in its race and the stars in their courses have lent their beams, perhaps only, to light me into perdition. I have pursued shadows and entertained myself with dreams. I have been treasuring up dust and sporting myself with the wind. I might have grazed with the beasts of the field or sung with the birds of the woods to much better purposes than any for which I have lived. This is what this man is saying. Life is bland, flat, tasteless, insipid, meaningless on the horizontal level. He says it. Now that's Solomon's first comparison. Verse 18 is the second comparison. Two different approaches to labor, to work. Now listen up, those of you who are working and those of you who are waiting for somebody else to work for you, both are applicable. Verse 18, he continues. Then I hated all my labor in which I toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will rule over all my labor which I toiled, which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. Therefore, I turned my heart and despaired of all the labor in which I had toiled under the sun. For there is a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. For what has man for all of his labor and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun? Now remember, Solomon chose a lifestyle of entrepreneurial labor. He didn't do the work himself, but he made sure the work was done. He was an entrepreneur, a builder, a visionary, a manager, one who bettered his country by his building, one who bettered himself by his building. He worked, he labored, he toiled. He was a workaholic in ancient terms. He was a workaholic because what he did, he tried to satisfy himself. He tried to fill the hole in his soul. He thought, I'm going to build this. Oh, I feel so good doing it. And then it was all done, and he thought, I don't feel good anymore. The project is over. It's all empty. Now he's taking a different approach. He knows he can't fulfill himself by the activity of my present life, so perhaps I can become satisfied in the thought that I can pass down my legacy and my wealth to my progeny, my children. I'll be satisfied in that. That'll be great. If I can't be satisfied in the here and now, I'll be fulfilled in the knowledge of the later on. And as he thinks about that, his mind wanders on the, uh-oh, but what if my children are fools? What if the person who sits on the throne after me, my son, which was Rehoboam, is like a wingnut, and he destroys everything I've built? And he starts thinking about this. Is it better to work hard yourself, or is it better to receive something as an inheritance? Can a person really appreciate something he's never worked for himself? Probably not. What if they're fools? Will they be wise? By the way, this was sort of the thinking of post-war America. My parents, at least, worked hard. They sacrificed, they saved, they toiled to give their children something better. But Solomon carries that a little bit further. And how many fathers or parents have passed something on to their children only to have their hearts broken by foolish, irresponsible activities? And by the way, it happened to Solomon. He gave it all to Rehoboam. And Rehoboam was a wingnut. He was a goofball. Man, he taxed people more than Solomon had taxed them. He split the kingdom in two because of his greedy activities. And that is what worried Solomon in these musings. Look at verse 23. We haven't covered it yet. For all his days are sorrowful, his work is burdensome. Even at night his heart takes no rest. This also is vanity. You get his drift? What good is working when all you do during the day is work up a sweat, and at night you worry up a storm? Sleep deprivation at night because you're worried about the future. Did I get it all done? Who will get it? Here is the bottom line of all of his labor. It's as if he is saying, for all of the effort that life requires, you get very little in return. And so I despaired. Anxious thoughts. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal a while back. They covered an interesting group of men in California. They meet once a year. They're notable, famous, wealthy guys who have a lot of anxiety in their lives. They get together for a weekend, and they call this the cremation of care. The cremation of care. What they do is they burn an effigy of care. They personify care by an effigy. They burn it, and as it burns, the band plays, "We're going to have a hot time in the old town tonight." It's to get their mind off their anxieties in their lives. Well, the Wall Street Journal interviewed one of the guys who was involved in this, and the man said the ceremony symbolized that whatever our problems are, our pressures, our anxieties in the real world, this is a special time to go away and invite a different range of emotions and feelings. It might sound good, but the Wall Street Journal concluded after interviewing him, this is an attempt to escape anxiety, but after the weekend is over, the worries always return. That's Solomon's drift in verse 23. Hard work, working up a sweat, sleep deprivation, tossing and turning at night, the anxiety always returns. That's his outlook. As he looks around at life, he compares life's pathways. No matter which one you take, it's empty. Rich, empty. Poor, empty. Wise, empty. Foolish, empty. Work hard, empty. Get an inheritance, empty. I'm sure glad there's three verses left, aren't you? This is where it gets good. He now takes a look up. It's like for the first time in the book, he dares to glimpse above the sun rather than just looking under the sun. It's a rare glimpse for Solomon in this book. There's a few of them. He begins to understand life's purpose. You know, it's amazing, and I've said it before, that you can take two different people and have them look at the same thing and see two different realities, it would seem. An example would be if you looked east at the Sandia Mountains from this angle, you would say they're steep, they're sparse, they're precipitous. If you go to the other side and look at the same Sandia Mountains, you'd say they're gentle, they're sloping, they're verdant, forested. Same mountains, two different angles. How about those spies that came back after looking at the Holy Land and coming back to Moses, and 10 of them said, there's some big folks in that land. They're giants. We're grasshoppers in their sight. We're toast, man. And then up stepped Joshua and Caleb, who said, now, wait a minute. We saw those giants. I know they're big. That just means they're easier to hit. You can't miss something that big. Let's go for it. Solomon does that with life, but it's not two different people. It's the same guy with a different perspective. Looking at life as this general outlook versus looking at life with God in view. And by the way, this is the first time he starts mentioning God, and he mentions God four times in the next few verses. Look at verse 24. There are three truths that he brings out with this outlook, The first truth is that creation cannot produce satisfaction. Verse 24, he says, nothing is better for a man than that he should eat and drink, that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. Now that isn't the best translation. It sounds like he's just saying, well, you might as well just eat, drink, and be merry. Nothing is better than that. But you see that little phrase, nothing is better? Literally, it should be translated, there is nothing in man. There is nothing in man. Let me give you the verse as it ought to be translated. It is in some translations. There is nothing in man that he should eat, drink, and find enjoyment in all his toil. In other words, there's nothing inside of us, the creation of God, that enables us to find enjoyment enough to carry us through life. We don't have it within ourselves. No matter how we look on this level, no matter what we produce, either wealth or a family or a business, it won't carry us through in terms of satisfaction. There's nothing inherently within man. And then verse 25, for who can eat or who can have enjoyment more than I? That's what my translation says. Some of your translations render it the way it ought to be. It says, for who can eat or who can have enjoyment apart from him? That's better. Here's his drift. Without God in your life, without putting God in the center of your life, life isn't satisfying. It's barely satisfactory. There is nothing within creation, whether it's in nature or it's in a relationship, there's nothing that will carry us through in terms of long-term satisfaction. Nothing. My mind goes back to a doctor that I worked for in Southern California. I don't ever remember seeing him smile. Yet, he was the wealthiest man I knew at the time. The foyer of his house, it was a big foyer. I mean, the foyer was bigger than my house. The foyer, the entranceway, had rare paintings from all over the world. He was notable in the medical community all over Southern California, but he never smiled. The stuff he bought or did never brought him happiness. Happiness is not found in God's creation apart from bringing the Creator in. There's a second truth. Look at verse 24 more carefully. Nothing is better for man, or there is nothing within man, that he should eat, drink, that his soul should enjoy good in its labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. And then verse 26, for God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight. God's gift to mankind is enjoyment. That's the second truth he comes to in this passage. That's his outlook. God gives enjoyment to man as a gift. God wants you to enjoy life. Some of you, I venture to say, still have from your upbringing the idea of the angry God with his arms folded, frown on his face kind of a God. Don't you dare have fun. Don't you dare be happy. Come to me and I will zap all of the joy out of your life. He's not a cosmic killjoy. He comes to give joy. That's part of the fabric of humanity. Not that that's to be our highest pursuit. But when we're rightly related to God, the byproduct is joy. Paul was right on when he wrote to Timothy and said, God has given us all things richly to enjoy. And there ought to be a joy in our labor, our work. I love what I do. I can only speak for myself. I don't do what I do because I have to do it. Listen, I don't get up Sunday morning and go, oh man, it's Sunday. I hate it. Now, I know a lot of people that do that Monday morning. First, oh, Monday, I hate Mondays. There are aspects of the ministry that are wearisome, that are less enjoyable than others, but it's a thrill for me. I figure with the study, the preparation, and the presentation of the messages I give alone, that's about 60 hours a week on top of the other stuff, but it is an absolute thrill for me to do it. There's an enjoyment built into it. There ought to be. It's a gift from God. Now notice something in that verse a little more carefully. Back in verse 24, notice the activities that are mentioned. Eat, drink, labor. Those are the three activities mentioned in the verse. Those are what we would consider mundane, everyday activities. Get up, eat, you drink, go to work. Come home from work, eat, drink, go to bed. Get up, eat, drink, go to work. These three activities are in this verse. Those are the monotonous things we do every day. And yet he says to enjoy them is a gift from God. Monotonous activity, the activities that you do every day without change, can make people bored and discontented. Unless, and here's the key, unless you place God in the middle of that even mundane activity, then your joy can be replenished. And I'm speaking to some of you who have jobs that you would say, this is really boring. What I do is a drag. I can't get any joy out of it. Well, listen to that again. Eat, drink, labor. I can have joy replenished by putting God in the middle of it. I found another news article. It was from a Boston newspaper about a woman who worked for 40 years as a cleaning lady in an office building. Now, here's her life for 40 years. She goes to work, has a mop, has a bucket, has cleaner, gets water, cleans the office, does that every day, every week, every month, 40 years. So the newspaper interviewer said, boy, you must get bored doing such monotonous activity every day, 40 years. You want to hear her answer? She said, oh, I don't get bored. I use cleaning materials that God made. I clean objects that belong to people that God made. And I make life more comfortable for them. My mop, she says, my mop is the hand of God. Monotonous, boring work, but takes on a whole different complexion when you place God in the center of it. There is a third truth, and we close with this. God cares for those who seek Him. Verse 26, for God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in His sight, better translation, who pleases Him. But to the sinner, He gives the work of gathering and collecting that He may give it to him who is good before God. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Let me explain that. There's an interesting irony in the acquisition of wealth. Solomon noticed that God often in His sovereignty will make sure that all that the ungodly work for and amass get given to the godly. Maybe the offspring gets converted and gives it to missions or the church work or whatever. But there's this twist in the acquisition of wealth. And God makes sure that His kids get their fair share of it for the work of God. Now, if you live to please God, this is terribly exciting. If you live just for yourself, as He says in the last part of that verse, this is vanity and grasping for the wind. A couple of examples come to mind. Up the road, just a few hundred miles, is an interesting little house, a castle to be exact, called Glen Eyrie. It's run by the Navigators, a fine Christian organization, but it wasn't built by them. They occupy it. They run it. It was built by General William Palmer, who was the founder and director of the Colorado Springs Railroad Company way back when. He built this nice little 35-bedroom castle for his wife, who came from England, thinking it'd make her happy, remind her of England. And so she lived in this castle for about a week, week and a half. She didn't want to live out in desolate Colorado Springs when you come from England. Didn't last long, but today it's in the hands of the Christian organization, the Navigators, and conferences, Bible studies, discipleship take place in terms of conferences there week in and week out. Interesting how it ended up. Another example is the home of Voltaire. Remember that name? Back in the 1700s, Voltaire was one of the most outspoken atheists of his day, mocked Christianity, knocked it, spoke out against it, and he made a prophecy of sorts. In 1778, Voltaire said, "Within 100 years, Christianity will be swept out of existence." Ha! Within 50 years, his home was being used by the Geneva Bible Society to print and distribute Bibles throughout Europe. Isn't that a twist? Isn't that great? Jesus said, "Seek first the kingdom of God, all these things will be added unto you." So in the midst of the outlook that was very dismal, he has this sudden flash of insight, this uplook. He considers God, and these three truths emerge. This weekend, we're following on the heels of Thanksgiving, right? Great week. Time to be thankful. Now, Thanksgiving is all about the uplook, isn't it? We come, we gather together as families, and no matter what the outlook, what the disease, what the financial outlook, we pause and we give God thanks. We look up. We realize that happiness is not found by direct pursuit. Happiness is a byproduct of rightly relating to God. Now, as we close, I'm going to plant a thought in your mind. I want you to compare Solomon with all of his lavish, posh lifestyle, all that he owned, all that he was, and his corresponding unhappiness with somebody else who was poor and who was blind. Her name was Fanny Crosby. Weird name, granted. Terrific lady. She wrote some of the great hymns of the church that are still sung today. She was blind almost from birth. Shortly after she was born, she became blind, and she stayed so until she died at about 90 years of age. So her whole life, 90 years in total darkness. She wrote these words in poem form. "Oh, what a happy child I am, although I cannot see. I am resolved that in this world contented I will be. How many blessings I enjoy that other people don't. To weep and sigh because I'm blind, I cannot and I won't." No, she wasn't the kind to throw the baseball in the air and just say, "Strike three." She was the kind to throw it in the air, miss perhaps, and say, "You know, I'm the greatest pitcher that ever lived. I can do all things through Christ." It's all about the uplook. And too many of you have looked around for too long. And frankly, that's why some of you are here this morning, because you're hungry and thirsty for more. You wonder, is there anything to the uplook? There's a whole lot. It's all about perspective.